Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, we have Angie Miller and Steve O'Neill speaking on the topic of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted, the Catholic worker movement. So let's listen in on Steve and Angie.
The idea that prayer, with prayer, you can go on doing the work that you do, and without it, it's going to be fruitless.
What's it like at the house you're at? Where are you with?
Well, we're with the Catholic Worker House in Duluth, and we talked a lot about it last night, and so we didn't want to repeat it all again because some people are here again. But it's we have morning prayer, but it's completely optional. So whoever wants to come can come, and we usually somebody just brings something to read, and lots of times it's from the Bible, but sometimes it's not. And then we have like 20 minutes of or 15 minutes of silence. Before Advent and before Lent, we do a series that's Christian Bible study, basically, and worship. And we do call ourselves a Christian community, but not everyone in the community is Christian. Everyone has, spiritual beliefs.
It's ecumenical in membership, so to speak.
Right.
Style.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's only, right now, I think two of us are Catholic. Me.
Just him.
And Mike was a recent Catholic convert, actually.
He's Jewish, and he converted. Oh, really? Yeah.
I was reading that in your newsletter.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Angie was a Missouri Synod Lutheran.
Oh, yeah?
When I was born, yeah. and the other, I think, principle that is still true today is that Catholic worker houses are communities. And people live in community and share what they have. And in some houses, it's a community with no hierarchy, and some houses are incorporated, and there's a board of directors and maybe a director of the community who's paid. And, it's quite a variety of ways to do things. In our house, in our community, no one is paid and no one's a director. It's pretty much run by consensus. But that varies a lot, too.
Right. But clearly, the vision that Peter and Dorothy had was that the houses would be kind of run consensually, that there would be no paid staff, there wouldn't be incorporation. They wrote pretty definitively about that. But when you think about it, as you see how the church has evolved, over the centuries, those same kinds of struggles have happened and continue to happen. So there's kind of, that vision of how it started and how they thought it should be. And some houses try to remain pretty true to that. Other communities, have veered one way or another.
Mm-hmm. You need this?
Yeah.
A little list?
Okay. The next kind of precept or principle is resistance. I mentioned Dorothy, picketing the bishop's house, but she and early day Catholic workers, about 3 years after the workers started, they started to write pretty specifically about the need to love one's enemy, to be pacifist, to be nonviolent. And that, of course, got them in trouble, with the mainstream Catholic Church as well. And they continued to be, really be strict pacifists through World War II. About half of the circulation of the newsletter dropped off at that time. A lot of Catholics and people in general just could not go with that stand. Through the 1950s, as you can imagine, things didn't get much better. The McCarthy era, and as well as I was just going to read a real short story here, but Angie was just saying about the FBI.
Oh, in the 70s, I think some of the New York Catholic workers wrote away for the files, and it was 500 pages.
Dorothy's files?
Yeah, and the New York Catholic Worker. It does say in there that Edgar Hoover, is that his name? Yeah. he put her on a list of people to be rounded up and detained in the event of a national emergency.
Sure.
That Dorothy's name was on there. And I think that what drew the attention at that time in the 50s to the community was that they were opposing the air raid drills in New York City. Is that what you're going to read about?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because they would have picnics in Central Park when everyone else was ordered. It was the law that you had to go into the subways, and they had these evacuation drills.
The one, they put up the sign on the worker that said, "This house has no fallout shelter. Peace is our only protection." So this would have been 1955. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Angie was talking about, they organized this. For several years, they did these kind of counter air raid drills. And it's kind of interesting. Is that, at one point in 1957, they were sentenced to 30 days in jail. And the writer here says, "Putting Dorothy Day in jail was something like throwing Brer Rabbit in the briar patch. It's good to be here, Lord," Dorothy wrote from her cell in the women's house of detention, not far from the bar she used to drink with Eugene O'Neill. "We were, frankly, hoping for jail," she admitted. "Being in jail, one could come closer to real poverty. Then we would not be running a house of hospitality. We would not be dispensing food and clothing. We would not be ministering to the destitute, but we would truly be one of them." And anyway, that went on through the 60s. In fact, this picture on the cover, you know, is a picture of her about to be arrested. This was in civil rights. Delma, right with the United Farm Workers.
Oh, okay.
Right, she was pretty close to Chavez for a number of years. But she was involved in civil rights. And again, you know, we're talking a lot about her, but Catholic workers really throughout the country have embodied that. Amon Hennessy is probably the other kind of famous Catholic worker that really felt that being Christian really depended on people's being willing to put their body on the lines for their beliefs. And so that went on in throughout many workers. We are kind of sister communities with a Catholic worker farm in near Luck, Wisconsin. We joke that it's just out of luck, but Luck is a little town about 75 miles northeast of the Twin Cities. And at any rate, these folks, there's about five or six of them there right now, are really a Catholic worker farm dedicated to resistance. That's primarily what they do. They do just a little bit of hospitality. They do give us some food that they raise, some maple syrup every spring that they tap, and they relate to an old Catholic worker community in Minneapolis, St. Joseph's House. But mostly what they do is organize resistance and then partake in resistance around nuclear weapons and militarism, most notably the ELF project, which is a Trident nuclear submarine communication system in northern Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So we are going to be talking all about that part of Catholic worker thinking and resistance at another session, so I'll hold on that. Roundtable on education. We've talked some about the newsletter. The newsletter was thought to be one of the real education forums, and most Catholic worker communities have their own little newspaper. We brought some of ours. I think I passed around. Oh, here's one from
San Antonio.
So most workers have a newsletter that comes out periodically. Sometimes they come out when there's enough money to put them out. We also do roundtable discussions, which was something that Peter really felt very strong about. He had this whole vision of scholars and workers coming together to share their thinking and their perspectives. And he organized the first round table, and he was so sure it was going to be a big success, he rented this huge hall in New York that, you know, that he had to pay for it and everything. Money was pretty scarce for them. And Peter was not an organizer. He put a few posters up here and there. 15 people showed up, in this mammoth hall. So, but out of that, this round table idea really stuck. And so Catholic workers throughout the country do round tables. And the New York worker has had a round table pretty much since 1933, almost every week. Mm-hmm. Usually they have theirs on Friday nights. And they have different scholars and workers and, you know, people who have something to say about some moral, theological, justice-related issue or concern. People recently back from other parts of the world or other parts of the country. And so we have followed, you know, like suited our worker, and we generally have a round table every month. And generally, I would say 20, 25 people, 30 people show up for ours. And again, you know, a variety of people, from some of our guests to, people up at the U and so on. And then the other tenet or principle is that of simple living. And, some people would call it voluntary poverty. I don't think that, Dorothy and Peter, as you can see even from the little thing that I just read, felt that was an important part of Catholic worker, and that poverty, much like St. Francis, you know, would embrace poverty. Felt that was important to be close to God, to be close to God's people, and that really there was a preferential option for the poor, as the church now talks about. So they did try to live that. I would say most Catholic working communities live that in a combination of choice and just the way things are.
In the big cities, the houses are really in, a lot of them are in pretty dangerous neighborhoods and pretty rundown houses, and where in the smaller towns and medium-sized cities, I think that's less true. Our three houses are actually pretty nice, and you know, we eat lots of good food, like we were saying, like here, and I don't feel in any way it's really poverty. But I think some houses live pretty close to the edge, but I don't feel that so much at our house. I mean, there's nobody getting shot down the, you know, on the street corner and that where we are in Duluth. But there definitely are houses that are located in neighborhoods like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, what we and I think many Catholic worker communities try to do is to earn, if they work, to earn under taxable income. Part of that, you know, is a whole decision to not pay war taxes, and to try to, in some ways, you know, keep ourselves from stepping out of some sense of simple living. I was just going to read a short thing here on kind of early dumpstering. In 1937, the New York House was feeding about 400 people a day. By the next year, that number had doubled. Most of the food they were receiving was either bagged or given. Much of the food was past selling date, day-old bread, vegetables, and fruit going rotten. Those who prepared the meal throughout wouldn't eat themselves and found ways to make good use of the rest. Even rock-hard bread makes excellent bread pudding. And occasionally the meal was made from first-class ingredients, a gift from a rectory convent or sympathetic food merchant. In later years, a visitor to the Catholic Worker one day asked a staff member, Tom Cornell, if there was any standard to be applied in accepting free food. Of course, said Tom, nothing but the best. The best is none too good for God's poor. And certainly this had been long Catholic Worker thinking, you know, as well. We learned our dumpstering skills at the Community for Creative Nonviolence in Washington, D.C., who were really masters of dumpstering. And in fact, put on a dumpstered gourmet dinner for Congress one year. that was, you know, exceptional. I mean, you couldn't believe all the great things we got from dumpsters in BC. Not just, you know, restaurant dumpsters and grocery store dumpsters, but primarily wholesale dumpsters, you know, where you would go to the big...
vegetable market.
Vegetable produce market, you know, and there would be like a whole dumpster full of tomatoes. And some of them would be bad and some of them would be perfect. You know, they just didn't have the... They didn't feel like they were going to put the money, the labor into sorting things. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can go on down the line. We also would go over to the fish market, which was down the way. This was in Jessup, Maryland. And we would both beg fish and we would ask for fish that, you know, they were going to throw out, particularly on Fridays because they were closed on Saturdays and Sundays. And we would get beautiful fish and squid and octopus and mm-hmm. everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, nothing wrong with it.
They just didn't want to keep it till Monday.
Yeah, nothing wrong with it. You know, just had to serve. I mean, it was still on ice and everything, so we weren't, weren't taking any risks there. So the Catholic workers tried to maintain that perspective of not wasting and trying to live somewhat simply. And then lastly is the whole notion of Peter's agronomic universities. And Peter had quite a vision of that the Catholic worker wasn't going to just be an urban thing, but it was going to be, you know, out in the land as well, that people needed to be part of the earth and to be one with the earth, and that people who were living in the city needed an opportunity to be able to get out into the farm, and that people needed to have the opportunity to grow their own food, and, you know, and so on. So they bought a couple farms in the early days with donated money, and just an interesting little blurb here. Yet community life at Mary Farm, as it was named, proved difficult and often grim. "Eat what you raise and raise what you eat," said Peter Moran, who came to live at Mary Farm. Unfortunately, there were always more people interested in eating food than in raising it, who preferred a discussion of theology or politics than to care for the fields or repair a hinge. Sometimes food was so short, physical battles would explode, such as the disappearance of an egg that a resident had set aside for lunch. Peter, who witnessed the fight, responded with a Gandhian-like vow to do without eggs and milk for the rest of the summer, thus shaming the combatants into a brief truce. His act of self-denial animated a debate within the community as to whether justice came before love. So, and you know, we've seen little examples of that too. Probably more so when we lived at the Community for Creative Nonviolence, where food was in short supply. But we, you know, we have three or four gardens. We have got community close friends who have farms, particularly one couple that has a farm that we go out and plant potatoes and onions and so on with them every year, and then weed once or twice and then go out for the harvest. And so we try to maintain some kind of tie with the land. You know, I mentioned this farm near Luck, Wisconsin. Catholic worker farms, you know, they continue to pop up, and they have throughout the, you know, the 60 years of Catholic worker. But I'd have to say, sadly, they have largely failed and have been pretty short-lived. You know, Peter's ideas seem so right on, you know, but it's hard. And, you know, the other thing is most Catholic workers come from the city, and they don't know diddly about farming or even gardening, you know. And unfortunately, you know, those of you who have gardened know that, you know, it takes a while to learn how to do it, and you have to do it every day.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, not everybody really is destined for that, I'm afraid. And fortunately, we in our community, we've been blessed with some really good gardeners, and you know, we've stuck with them. We've had some great gardens, but boy, I have seen. I did just visit St. Francis House in Chicago on the north side. I don't know if you know the house.
Uptown.
Yeah. And they have just a sensational garden. I was talking to the head gardener there, and he said, you know, this year we're doing great. We've got some really good volunteers, but other years, you know, I mean, you know, the weeds get...
They had 10-foot corn. It was Wow. It was amazing. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
I noticed that cartoon in that issue up here
mm-hmm.
about the gardening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's right now there's a wonderful Catholic Worker cartoonist from Rock Island.
Yeah,
from the Quad Cities,
Rock
Island, Moline.
That's where he's lived his cartoons.
With Heaven House. Heaven House is his cartoon serial. It's like a Catholic Worker Doonesbury of sorts. It's really fun. So that's, I mean, that's kind of a summary of kind of the principles of Catholic Worker.
I'm gonna go meet new staff. We'll see you guys later.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Margo. Thinking and so on. And maybe, you know, I was gonna talk a little bit about some of the other houses that we're familiar with, but maybe first is this a good time to open it up. And you know, we don't know, we know Brian and we knew Margo, but we don't know you and you.
Mike Brown.
Mike. And you're?
I'm Bernie Meyer.
Bernie.
Yeah. I have a lot of history with the Catholic Worker movement, so I just thought I'd come.
Oh, do you? Well, tell us about it. If you want.
Be glad to. You know, it's kind of fit and start and back and forth. I was ordained a Catholic priest in Cleveland in 65 and got involved in the inner city and peace movement and things like that. So. In those few years, the late 60s, you know, I was baptized into the Catholic Worker as well as all the social issues coming up. And I had the opportunity to go to the Catholic Worker Farm in New York, typically for the Pax Christi Conference, where I met Dorothy and Jim Douglas and a lot of other folks who were known and not known.
Right, yeah.
Through that initiation, ended up being kicked out of the church a few years ago for protesting and things, and we started the Thomas Merton community in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I'm from. And I just came back in July from the 25th anniversary of that initiation. And I lasted about 3 years there, and you know, in the community, and still maintain a very close relationship to a lot of the folks. The Thomas Merton community was motivated out of the Catholic Worker movement from Dorothy and from Casa Maria in Milwaukee and others. But it didn't quite connect as a pure Catholic Worker, whatever that is.
There aren't too many of them.
But there is another Catholic Worker group that's arisen in Cleveland. I saw you have one of the newspapers from it. Part of our 25th reunion was a roundtable discussion at the Catholic Worker in the first part of July. So we have me to catch up with a lot of developments that have left happened since then. So.
And that community is still going then, the Thomas Merton community.
It is and it isn't. It has an identity there. What happened was I had co-founded the Catholic Peace Movement as a priest, active, without the bishop's permission. And that group was struggling with what the hell is the Catholic teaching on peace. We were trying to learn that. And another priest had been working in the suburbs around fair housing and other things. He had study groups in his church. And we're both frustrated with the church and living in a very racist, oppressive community. We decided to, at one point, confront the church. And that's when the other priest and I got arrested for confronting the church. And Mike Cullen from the Casa Maria in Milwaukee coming up and talk, and other people from the Milwaukee 14, but from Boston and a place like that, Jim Forrest, coming through Cleveland, talking about what's happening across the country and the meaning of the Catholic Worker. So we decided, the lay people and the two priests decided to move to the near west side of Cleveland. And we had 40-some people move in, some people with families, 4 or 6 kids. You know, bought houses and moved down. I moved into a commune of single folks, and that was quite an experience.
What years were these?
60. The action took place in where we got arrested in January of 69, and we moved to the near west side of Cleveland and formed the Merton community in June of 69. So we had people of all ages, backgrounds, you know, and a lot of things started with all that mix of talent and ability. It started as somewhat of a resistance community, with a resistance arm. And,
right.
Of course, I got arrested several times, and others did, but others did not. And we bookstore, a soup kitchen, a storefront for alcoholics, daycare. A lot of these things started in immediate years, and then it's gone on from there. So a lot of the originators are still there, and I still feel very connected to them. Mm-hmm. Washington now, in Olympia, and I'm related to the Catholic worker in Olympia, but it's probably very un-Catholic worker in its membership as well as some of its style. Mm-hmm. But in Tacoma, there's a Catholic worker. In Seattle, there's a Catholic worker. There's a Catholic worker farm in Chehalis, Centralia area, mm-hmm. and I connect loosely with all these.
So that's great. That's great. That's...
And I lived in Denver for 5 years and was in on the initiation of Catholic worker there by Anna Coop and a group of other people. Mm-hmm. They're still very close to me and mm-hmm. what happens.
Great. Great. Yeah.
I just thought I'd see what you're here doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
How it fits into my life.
That's great.
Actually, the reason why I'm here, I'm curious why people do this. I mean, I'm kind of intrigued with it. Uh-huh. But I'm not sure I have a strong calling for that, but it's good work. And, so I'm wondering what happens to people after they do this. Do they stay in the movement or do they move on to other places like you?
It varies, yeah. Yeah. The whole spectrum of reactions. I mean, Dorothy lasted her whole life, and there are people like her who are able to do it. I got married, and kids came, and health issues came, and kind of, for health reasons, had to evolve out of it, you know, and I feel lost there and yet the commitment, so it varies.
I think for a lot of people, though, it's for a few years. We tried a few years because, like you said, it is. It's hard to do with when you have kids. That's what we found. And other Catholic workers that we've talked to, there's lots of them with babies and little kids. But then once their kids get to be like 9 and 10 and 11, then there's a revolt. I mean, there's not very many families that are in Catholic worker houses. There are some, and they're just amazing to me because, I mean, we lived in a hospitality house for 5 years until about 3 weeks ago, and then we've moved. We're still part of the community, but
we moved down the block.
Your family moved, you mean?
Just our family.
Nuclear family.
Right.
Right. Yeah, after 5 years. And it was when our daughter got to be 9 and she really started saying that she didn't want to live here anymore and she was unhappy. I think, you know, what draws people, I think, is different. Some people are really drawn to the resistance and they see that by living in community, you can live a life of resistance. You know what I mean? Like community enables you to do resistance in a way.
Go to jail once in a while.
In a way you maybe couldn't do if you lived on your own.
Yeah.
Because you get tremendous support.
Okay.
You know, you're going to have a home to come back to.
Mm-hmm. When you get out, if you're gone for months.
If you lose your job, no problem. you're going to eat. You're going to have a place to stay. You're going to get a letter every day. And I will say, Catholic workers are really good about supporting people in jail, and not just themselves too. I mean, gosh, workers write to all sorts of people in jail, visit people in jail. You know, which, I mean, of course, you know, again, a work of mercy. You know, So there is that. But I think other people, like in our community, where we do some resistance, but we do a lot of hospitality, most of our members have been drawn to do hospitality, I think. You know, they want to live with poor people, and they want to do that, provide that kind of hospitality, but not necessarily work in a big shelter or a big soup kitchen, you know. So, and you know, like Angie said, though, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons why people do it. I mean, people, we've had people who really didn't enjoy the hospitality, were not that drawn to the resistance, but wanted to lead prayerful lives, and realized that they couldn't just pray. You know, they weren't ready to be Trappist, you know, and they wanted, they felt there was more to it than that, so they would offer some hospitality and maybe do a little bit of resistance and pray a lot, you know. And so, you know, there certainly are different reasons. And we do have, you know, that have made at least a one-year commitment to be part of the community right now. And then we have one person who's with us for several months, like an intern of sorts. But we have many volunteers, some of whom have started with us, you know, when we started five-some years ago. And, you know, bring a meal every month, or come and do a shift at the house, you know, where they answer the phone and they clean the house and so on. And, you know, so there are a lot of different ways that people relate to the community and come to the round tables regularly and, you know, help out in the Lenten and Advent discussions and, you know, a variety of things. We're here at Holden largely because of volunteers, you know, Lutheran volunteers from our community.
But what happens if you get sick? What happens if you get older?
Okay.
You know, you don't... It seems to me that you don't have that support like retirement or other things like that. That you know, you're saying that's not important.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
As far as saving money for your retirement.
Yeah. Or not saving money so much, like you don't have some corporation putting money in for you that's going to support you.
No.
Right. Right. That is right.
So
right.
That's not that important to me.
Right.
Right.
Right. We do have one of our members, workers right now. Ron recently reached his 62nd birthday and went on to Social Security. And we all pay 20% of our income into the community pot. So his is actually one of the bigger.
Well, he worked, you know, he had a long work history.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah, he was a machinist for many years, so he made pretty good money.
Uh-huh. His Catholic worker life is a recent part of his life.
Yeah.
But you know, there are some older people in the Catholic worker movement, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
Particularly
in the communities that have been around for a while. You know, I visited the New York house a few years ago, and there's a couple members there in their 60s, one in the 70s. I visited the LA worker a few months ago, which is an old Catholic worker and a wonderful Catholic worker community. Have you been down there?
No, I haven't.
That's a great community.
See the newspaper once in a while.
Great newsletter, The Agitator.
They've done a lot.
They have done a lot. And they're a really resilient community. When Angie and I decided in 82 that we wanted to kind of join a community, and we didn't know it was a Catholic worker or what we were going to be, and we explored a lot of different communities. CCNV probably was more like your Merton community, because it came out of the Vietnam War. It was kind of a resistance to the war community. It had some Catholic worker ideals, but didn't call themselves a Catholic worker. The LA worker, on the other hand, which is also 20, 25 years old, just a couple interesting stories. They were, they have a big soup kitchen in a really kind of rough area of LA, right out of downtown. And the old Bowery. And it's, you know, because it's in LA, there are just hundreds and hundreds of people sleeping and sprawled out block after block. I mean, it's not like you see so much. I mean, New York, you see that some in the summer, but this is year-round there. You know, so it it's bigger. It's much more devastating to see than New York or the northern cities, you know, that I'm familiar with growing up in Chicago. But at any rate, so they're right in this area, and their big soup kitchen, they had an old kind of warehouse building, got destroyed in the earthquake back in 77, 79, big earthquake.
Okay.
And they had a big community too. In fact, I visited the LA Worker in 82 thinking we might move there and join there. They couldn't take any more members. They had too many people that wanted to join. They had about 30 some members then. And they just felt like that's as big as we want to be.
Yeah.
You know? So at any rate, after the earthquake, they decided rather than rebuild another big soup kitchen or buy another building or whatever, they built a little building to prepare the meal in, and they built an outdoor soup kitchen that is beautifully landscaped. Trees, bushes, paintings, murals, fountains,
a pool. Bird cages. It's
gorgeous. And so people, when they line up, and this is a soup kitchen that feeds, you know, hundreds of people a day, sometimes 1,000 people. So when they, you know how people will line up in those big lines, instead of lining up in really depressing kind of atmosphere, the line zigzags through these beautiful gardens and by the fountains and the pools and the birds. Yeah, they wheel these big cages of birds out of the soup kitchen building, you know, out.
Yeah.
And so it's really pretty amazing. They have a little medical clinic, and they had a legal clinic for a while. Now the community, kind of post-earthquake and post various other traumas and side, went down to about 5 or 6 members. But now they're bouncing back and they're up to 10 or 11. So yeah, you know, it's hard to say why people join, but
most people are a little nutty now.
Yeah.
It's true, don't you think? I mean, you know.
What do you think, Brittany?
Yeah.
I mean, in a good way, you know. Some in a.
I don't know, the people in Cleveland are pretty straight arrow by and large. I mean, but it was a pressure time. We did it more for our own self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pulled together. You know this mm-hmm. atmosphere. You know, everybody's against the blacks. Everybody's against the war, or for the war in Vietnam. And just a few of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idealism. If you heard Mike Cullen talk or Dorothy, I mean, you know, between the two, that our self-defense and the tremendous commitment and love and idealism that these people evoked.
Yeah.
Together.
Right.
But yeah, you know, looking around, you have to be, I don't know about nutty, but just
I meant maybe quirky or, you know.
Yeah.
We are always looking for members.
Take a chance.
And I would say most workers usually are looking for both members and people to help out.
Just people.
I always think when you get older and your children are off somewhere, that might be a good thing, not only fun, but good. What would happen if someone got really sick in your community? I mean, you could spend a lot of resources, you know, in a hospital. How would you deal with that?
Well, yeah, since we have,
question.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Minnesota, we're blessed with, you know, state health insurance. And, but, I mean, I will say, like, when we were at CCMV, you know, people got sick, you know, they went to the public hospital, you know.
Okay.
And most of these communities, I will say, you know, we're blessed with a lot of doctors, nurses who volunteer or who donate money to us regularly. And my guess is that if asked, you know, they would be willing to help us out.
Some people in our community have insurance from employment. That's kind of the exception, though. And some Catholic workers have insurance from, you know, medical assistance from the state, and some choose to live without insurance, including some families. I mean, the Catholic workers in Luck have no insurance, and they have 3 children.
But they're not anti-medicine. They're willing to go mm-hmm. to the public hospital.
Oh, yeah, they're not anti-medicine.
They get it wherever they can get it. It's just...
For them, it's financial. They don't make enough to buy insurance. And they have part-time jobs that don't give insurance, so you know it's a little risky. I mean, everything,
sure is.
A lot of things about hospitality and Catholic workers risky. I mean, inviting total strangers into your house is a scary thought as well to some people, as scary as living without health insurance would be for another person.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I was going to close. We can keep talking, but we have to kind of close it so they can turn the tape off, and then we have lunch.
We have to eat lunch.
But I wanted to just give you a sense of, and I guess, I don't know, Mike, if you've read any Peter Morin, but...
No, I just listened to one tape of Dorothy Day.
He wrote these different poems, and, you know, they're very simple, but they really are to the heart of the gospel, I think, and mm-hmm. to the heart of hopefully where we should be. This was written in 1933. People who are in need are not afraid to beg. Give to people not in need the occasion to do good for goodness sake. Modern society calls the beggar bum and panhandler and gives him the bum's rush. But the Greeks used to say that people in need are ambassadors of the gods. Although you may be called bums and panhandlers, you are in fact ambassadors of God. As God's ambassadors, you should be given food, clothing, and shelter by those who are able to give it. And he goes on and says, the poor are no longer fed, clothed, and sheltered at a personal sacrifice, but at the expense of the taxpayers. And because the poor are no longer fed, clothed, and sheltered at the personal sacrifices, the pagans say about the Christians, see how they pass the buck. And that, I think that kind of summarizes some of the Catholic worker thought.
Sounds very conservative.
You know, there is, I mean, there is that kind of, where, you know, conservatism meets, you know.
Yeah.
Radicalism.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. I would think a house like that would have an effect on the community also. It would be, I don't know, a source of hope. Mm-hmm. You know, struggling for words, but it would be a place people would say, well, I feel good because it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's true.
I always felt that for a lot of us, the Sermon on the Mount seems so unreasonable,
mm-hmm.
unachievable, and that people like Dorothy and the Catholic Order say, you can't live it.
Yeah.
It's a statement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can be done. And, you know, it's not that they do it, it's God working through it.
Even understanding the Beatitudes is so complex. I guess you have to live it. You know, mentally I can't go very far.
Yeah. I look at it in a big picture. What's happening in this world is shrinking in size because of population growth. We're consuming our resources at a terrible rate. And just from a self-interest standpoint, we should be living simpler. Add the gospel meaning of people being valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Every person's a person, child of God.
Right.
Put the two together. I mean,
yeah.
Peter Barnes,
it's just that
right
simple,
on.
Really.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it has to come down to being that simple.
Mm-hmm.
Our own self-interest and not going to close in upon ourselves. And that's. It's a challenge right now. People, you know, our society, American society, is going the route of the two classes and be like Mexico and Latin American countries. The wealthy have their fenced in compounds and everybody else is scrounging.
Yep. It really was fairly easy to start our house. I mean, it really was very simple. You know, I mean, we didn't ask anyone's permission or zoning laws or, you know, we just moved in and bought this house and wrote our friends and relatives and got enough money to fix up the third floor and started taking in people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really simple in a way. There wasn't any rigmarole or there wasn't even a lot of meetings or deep thought or, you know,
some prayer, reflection.
We just winged it.
Yeah.
It's a little hard to live it out when you got a number of adults, you know, and that consensus idea you're talking about, that's where the work comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Trying to struggle with
we only have the two of us starting out,
stuff.
So.
The two of you started it?
Right, so see, we didn't have to.